Hey there, it's Kathy. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to History of the 90s early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It was a gray fall day when Officer Chris Horsley boarded a Coast Guard helicopter. As he buckled in, he thought to himself, conditions were perfect for a search. The doors on both sides of the bright red helicopter were wide open as it took off and flew up the dark waters of the Gorge on Vancouver Island. Officer Horsley looked right, while another constable looked left. Below, they saw police divers who were also part of the search. As the helicopter traveled further up the waterway and over a bridge, Officer Horsley saw what they were looking for: the body of a teenage girl who'd been missing for over a week. I'm Kathy Canzora, and this is History of the 90s, a podcast about a decade that changed the world. Over the next two episodes, I'm joined by Caitlin and Graham Duffy, the co-hosts of the podcast True North, True Crime, as we look back at a Canadian murder that drew international attention and brought the issue of teen violence and bullying into the spotlight. This is the murder of Rena Virk. When Rena Virk was a toddler, her dad said she looked like a princess, which was fitting for a little girl whose name means queen in Hindi. Manjeet was a doting father to his firstborn. He read her books and sang lullabies, cherishing every moment with his young daughter. Rena's dad came to Canada from India in 1979. His original plan was to stay for 2 months while visiting his sister in Victoria on British Columbia's Vancouver Island. But while he was there, he fell in love and married Rena's mum, Suman. Another daughter and son soon followed Rena. The family enjoyed the beauty of BC, camping and swimming at local beaches. And they took fun road trips to places like Disney and Baja California. They were a typical family living an ordinary life. But Manjeet Virk says when Rena was around 10 or 11, the family entered what he calls rough waters. In his 2008 memoir, Virk writes that his daughter began talking back and picking fights with her mom. She withdrew and refused to go to church or any other family outings. According to Caitlin Duffy, who co-hosts the podcast True North, True Crime alongside her husband, Graham Duffy, Rena felt like she didn't fit in with her peers.
When Rena was in grade six, she was growing quite fast and felt trapped in a bigger body. She was bullied by other kids who teased her and excluded her. And because she was so unhappy, she stopped caring about her appearance and her hair was often unkempt, which made obviously this ridicule worse, as kids are mean in middle school. So by the time Rena entered Colquitt's middle school, she was already 5'8" tall and 180 pounds. And anybody who has been a 12 or 13 year old girl knows that that appearance is not really in line with other girls her age and was certainly not in line with the 90s feminine beauty standards that you would see in Maxim or MTV or Much Music and all of that.
In May 1994, the family moved to a new split-level house in Saanich, a massive municipality that's part of the Capital Regional District and surrounds the city of Victoria. Graham Duffy says that Saanich has well over 100,000 residents and includes 17 different neighborhoods.
Like Saanich kind of proper goes up the Saanich Peninsula, and it's a lot of farming properties and rural stretches. But then when you get closer to Victoria and sort of to the west of the Pat Bay Highway, you have this kind of centralized area of Saanich. And that is like, it's like suburban utopia. There's, you know, especially back in the 90s, there's like malls and fast food joints and like densely packed little neighborhoods.
Rena's parents hoped moving to Saanich would be a fresh start for their daughter. But at her new school, she was once again excluded and bullied. Then in the summer before high school, Rena began hanging out with some older teenagers she met at a local park.
And that's when Rena began to change her look. She was wearing kind of urban sportswear, sneakers, platform shoes, darker makeup, and unconventional nail polish colors like blue. She smoked pot and cigarettes and started listening to hip hop and rap. And she even claimed that she had joined the gang that is called the Crips, which was something the other kids in her age group had been claiming as well. And it seemed like the California gang culture was the very hip and cool thing at the time.
When Rena's parents discovered that her new friends smoked and sometimes stayed out all night, they tried to put a stop to it.
Rena Virk's parents came from a traditional background, and adding to that, they were also Jehovah's Witnesses, and they did their best to instill traditional and religious ideals in their kids. These beliefs, however, were obviously at odds with the other 90s kids. Many of Rena's peers were from relaxed, non-traditional white families.
Rena, unhappy with her parents' strict rules, decided to push back in a way that would cause a major rift in the Virk family. Rena complained to her new friends about her overbearing parents, and at some point, someone in the group suggested a way out. They advised her to tell authorities that her parents were abusing her. Then she would get sent to a foster home or a group home. So that's what she did. Rena's parents insisted the allegations were false, but a social worker decided it was best for the 13-year-old to stay with her maternal grandparents, who lived 2.5 kilometers away from the Virk family home. The situation got extremely messy over the next several months. While at her grandparents', Rena accused her father of sexual abuse. That led police to arrest Manji, but charges against him were eventually dropped when Rena recanted the allegations. The turmoil continued as Rena bounced around from place to place. First, she moved from her grandparents to a foster home, and then for a short period, she moved back home with her parents. Then, in November 1997, Rena said she wanted to go back to foster care. And while a social worker tried to sort out the situation, Rena went to an emergency youth shelter. That's where the 14-year-old met up with two teen girls with troubled backgrounds and a history of violence. It was a meeting that would have deadly consequences.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
On a night cold enough to freeze your bones, a prospector searching for a legendary cursed gold mine vanishes without a trace. I'm Crew Williams, the host of Dead Man's Curse. This season, we retrace the steps of fortune seekers looking for a motherlode worth billions who never came back. Join our quest June 3rd. Search for and follow Dead Man's Curse Volcanic Gold on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
At first, Rena adored Nicole Cook and Missy Plake. In her eyes, they were everything she wanted to be. Cool and tough, living by their own rules and afraid of nothing. Rena desperately wanted to be friends with them. And even though she did everything she could to get to know them, they kept her at arm's length. After a few days at the shelter, Rena returned home. And on Friday, November 14th, she planned to spend a quiet evening on her own. Then the phone rang. It was Nicole and Missy from the shelter, and they wanted Rena to hang out with them. Caitlin says Rena knew these girls weren't her biggest fans, so she was a bit suspicious about why they were inviting her out.
Nicole and Missy ended up convincing Rena that she wasn't in any danger and they just really wanted to be friends with her. They said, come party with us, it'll be fun. And so Rena, who was so desperate to be liked and accepted by her peers, changed her plans for that night, and she packed her backpack and made her way to that field at Shoreline School, hopeful that this might be the beginning of a different social life for her.
Rena met the girls in front of a nearby Walmart and then took a bus to Shoreline High School in View Royal, a suburb of Greater Victoria. The town is situated close to the Gorge Waterway, a 6-kilometer tidal river, which in the first half of the 20th century was a dumping ground for industrial and residential waste, making it unsafe for swimming, until a cleanup began in the 90s. At the time Rena was a teenager, View Royal was home to approximately 8,000 people, mostly working-class families. For some residents of Victoria, parts of View Royal were considered to be the wrong side of the tracks. On most Friday and Saturday nights, teens would gather in the field at Shoreline High School to hang out. The night that Rena went there with Nicole and Missy, about 50 or 60 other teens showed up to party at Shoreline. They drank vodka and smoked weed under a full moon shining so bright that it illuminated the field. The sky got even brighter at precisely 9:12 p.m., when stunning red and yellow light trails blazed over Victoria like silent fireworks. The glowing trails, which lasted for about 30 seconds, came from a piece of a Russian rocket as it fell back to Earth. The debris burned up as it hit the Earth's atmosphere and could be seen from Seattle to Victoria and Vancouver. The fiery display frightened many people, who called 911 and local police stations. Some of the teens gathered on the field at Shoreline School screamed when they saw the burst of lights in the sky. They wondered if it was a meteor shower or maybe a satellite. Shortly after the light show, a teenage boy in the crowd threw a rock at a school window, which prompted a janitor who was inside to call the police. When a cop car showed up, the kids scattered, heading in different directions. While that was happening, Nicole and Missy, the two shelter girls who had invited Rena to the party, put their real plan in motion. They, along with some other teenage girls, chased Rena to a nearby road and surrounded her. Rena ran to a phone booth and called home. Her little brother answered. She said to him, "I'm coming home. Can you tell Mom I'll be home soon?" On the other end, the young boy could tell his sister was crying and scared. He encouraged her as best he could and urged her to come home. Rena hung up but was afraid to leave the safety of the phone booth. She was surrounded by the group of teens who beckoned her to come out. They said they didn't want to fight. They wanted to party with her. Eventually, she stepped out of the phone booth and said, "I want to catch the bus. I have to go home." The teens wouldn't move. One of them took her bus pass and ripped it up. Nicole and Missy moved to either side of Rena, linking arms with her. Then, together, they walked toward a nearby bridge. The Craig Flower Bridge crosses the gorge waterway connecting View Royal and Saanich. On one side, a wooden staircase with a rusty railing descends from street level to an area under the bridge that resembles a dark cave. After being told to leave the Shoreline field, 14 girls, including Rena, along with two boys, gathered under the bridge. They stood around on muddy, uneven ground that sloped down to the water's edge. Then, suddenly, Nicole screamed at Rena. She asked, "Why are you trying to ruin my life?"
Nicole was very upset at Rena, and this is because Rena stole Nicole's phone book and had called numbers in that phone book belonging to, you know, Nicole was very popular. So Nicole knew everybody at Shoreline, and so everybody's numbers were in that phone book, and she called these numbers, and she spread the rumor that Nicole has AIDS, Nicole isn't as pretty as she used to be, Nicole looks like shit, all these things.
Rena insisted she wasn't to blame, but Nicole didn't care. She lunged forward and pushed a burning cigarette into Rena's forehead. That's when chaos erupted. Several other girls swarmed Rena, wildly punching and kicking, even though most of them didn't even know her. Some others scrambled up the hill, frightened by what they were seeing, but they did nothing to stop it.
There were upwards of, 20 kids present there that night who witnessed what happened, and not a single person called for help. Nobody. So nobody called police, ambulance, their parents. Nobody said anything.
As Rena lay on the ground, a boy by the name of Warren Glowatsky kicked her in the head until his friend grabbed him and told him to chill out. With her hands over her face, Rena pleaded, "Stop, please stop." But the beating continued, until one of the teens involved in the attack said it was enough. She raised her voice and said, "The next person to touch her gets a shot from me." Everybody scattered, and after taking a little bit of time to recover, Rena climbed the wooden stairs to street level. She staggered a little as she attempted to walk across the bridge toward her home. For most of the teens, it was the last they would ever see of Rena Virk. Manjeet and Suman Virk called the police when Rena didn't make it home that Friday night. In the morning, with still no sign of her, they called again. But the police said because of her troubled history, they wouldn't start searching until Monday. Unbeknownst to the police and Rena's parents, the teenage rumor mill was already working overtime. By Monday, everyone at Shoreline High School was talking about what happened that weekend under the bridge. Detailed whispers of the beating passed from student to student in the hallways and in the smoke pit. No one told a teacher, a parent, or any other adult about what they heard. The attack was kept secret among the students at Shoreline. But most of the kids didn't know the full story. They had no idea what happened to Rena after the assault under the bridge.
After that, Rena was left on the ground, and her eyes were swollen shut. She was bleeding from the nose and mouth, and she had a cigarette burn on her forehead. Her belongings had been taken from her. They stole her backpack. They broke her bottle of Polo Sport. And she was sort of left there. And Rena got up slowly, quite disoriented. My guess is concussed. And so when you're in that fight or flight mode, and she wasn't a fighter, that's the thing. So when you're in that flight mode, you want to get somewhere safe. And so she made her way up the stairs, because there were stairs along the side of the bridge where the kids would go down. And then she started making her way across to the north side of the bridge.
As Rena stumbled across the bridge, two of her attackers decided to follow her. One of them was 15-year-old Kelly Ellard, who was best friends with Nicole Cook, one of the girls Rena met at the shelter. The other was 16-year-old Warren Glowatsky, the boy who had kicked her in the head. They caught up to Rena on the other side of the bridge, and after a brief conversation, continued the vicious assault on Rena. They kicked and punched the 14-year-old until she was unconscious. Then each one grabbed one of Rena's legs and dragged her lifeless body and placed her face down into the gorge. Kelly Ellard, who was all of 5'4" and 115 pounds, then held Rena's head under the salty water until life drained from her body and she stopped moving. The pair then had a cigarette and promised one another not to talk about the incident with anyone. But neither one of them was very good at keeping a promise.
Kelly was then witnessed at a bus stop, soaking wet from the waist down, and she told the witness at the bus stop, "A girl died tonight." And her clothing would later dry, but forensics would show that there were salt water marks all over her clothing. So, and there's only one place to get salt water on your clothing in Victoria, and that's literally the gorge in the ocean.
The next day, Warren Glowatsky confessed to his girlfriend, while Kelly Eller told her best friend Nicole what happened. In turn, Nicole told her roommate at the youth group home where she was now living. The roommate, a 15-year-old girl, was the one who finally went to police, telling them about the beating and the murder. Surprisingly, though, police didn't initially believe her, even after they learned that Rena was in fact missing. Several more days passed while police looked into what the teen had told them. Then, on Friday, November 21st, exactly 1 week after the attack, police announced the arrest of 8 teenagers between the ages of 14 and 16. 6 girls were charged with aggravated assault, while a 16-year-old boy and 15-year-old girl were charged with second-degree murder.
We believe that there were other kids in that area. It's a popular hangout. As far as how many kids have firsthand knowledge of what actually took place, we are still going with those 8 for now. However, again, there could be more.
We have not ruled out the possibility that some of those charged with aggravated assault could be bumped up to second-degree murder.
What about the second-degree murder charge?
It's certainly a possibility. We have not ruled it out that even could be raised. Again, it's going to be based on the many, many people that we still have left to interview.
Because of their ages, the identities of all the teens arrested were initially protected by the Young Offenders Act. However, the names of Kelly Ellard and Warren Glowatsky, the two accused of killing Rena, were eventually released because they were tried as adults. And Nicole Cook and Missy Plyke have identified themselves in the media, which is why we're using their names in this episode. While the teens were questioned at the Saanich police station, officers and firefighters searched the shoreline and the gorge waterway looking for clues, but nothing was found. The next day, Saanich police officers boarded a red Canadian Coast Guard helicopter to begin an aerial search of the waterway. Within 20 minutes, they spotted something. Floating in the reeds, hidden by the tall brown stalks, was the body of a teenage girl, her long black hair floating out toward the shore. It was Rena Virk. When news of the shocking crime broke, the general public was stunned. It seemed unfathomable that a 14-year-old girl could have been killed by a group of her peers. And many wanted to figure out why.
This case is still very much the talk of the city, from the radio talk shows to people on the street.
I think it's a societal problem. I think it extends far beyond the schools. I think it starts with how we look at violence in society and how we treat it and how we react to it and respond to it.
We've lost the ability to guide and train our young people.
We have a major problem with our kids, and we have to find a way to deal with it.
Is it the school's problem or the whole community's problem?
No, it's not the school's problem. It's the community's problem.
Experts were quick to point out that violence among female teenagers had been on the rise since the mid-80s and had become a noticeable problem in the early 90s. Sybil Arts, a University of Victoria professor who wrote a book called Sex, Power, and the Violent Schoolgirl, warned that schools and parents needed to deal with the issue head-on to prevent things from getting worse. Arts said violence among teen girls had always been there, but it was more prevalent in the 90s because of the emphasis on girls becoming sex objects early in life. Other experts blamed violent movies, TV, and video games, suggesting that 90s youth, both girls and boys, were desensitized to the violence, and they had overcome their inhibition against killing. Canadian crime statistics seemed to show evidence that there was a problem. Between 1992 and 1996, overall youth crime in the country was down, thanks to a drop in property crimes committed by youth. But violent crimes among 12 to 18-year-olds had actually risen by 3.5%. With the highest number of violent youth crimes taking place in British Columbia, which saw a spike of nearly 40%. Graham Duffy grew up in Victoria, and he says he wasn't shocked when he heard about Rena's murder.
I knew that that place was a tinder keg, like with regards to the youth violence that was going on in Victoria. And I didn't feel safe walking around downtown Victoria. I know people might hear this and laugh, like, because it's horse-drawn carriages and flower pots and stuff. But kids got stomped. Like, it was like, and curb stomping, I had never heard of it before, but it was like a thing that people did. And so you really had your head on a swivel. And, you know, there was no Ubers or cell phones or anything like that. It was like, you know, you took the bus or you walked. And if you missed the bus, which was, you know, the last one was 10:30, 11 o'clock, then you were walking, like, in on dark streets.
The crime had made headlines across Canada and the US, and even as far away as France, Norway, and Sweden. And everybody wanted to know why. What could drive young people to commit such a horrible crime against another teen? When the eight teens charged in connection with the beating and murder appeared in court on the morning of Monday, November 24th, a horde of reporters and cameramen gathered outside the courthouse for updates. But police and the Crown Attorney were tight-lipped, releasing very few details. They would only say that Rena's official cause of death was drowning. The lack of specifics left a void which would be filled by rumors and incorrect information. In particular, there was talk that the murder was gang-related. Kids said that some of the accused were members of the notorious LA-based gangs, the Bloods and the Crips. But police said they were actually gang wannabes and insisted true gangs were not a problem in Victoria schools. Graham Duffy says local teens may not have been affiliated with LA gangs, but lots of predominantly white, affluent kids who were influenced by 90s rap culture tried to emulate thug life.
And that's when we started to see groups of kids crewing up, sort of thing. And they weren't gang members in the sense that they were moving large quantities of drugs or engaging in turf wars for survival. They were gang members in the sense that they were selling dime bags, they were picking fights with other groups, and they took on sort of the affect of the criminal lifestyle. And they took on names like the E-Town Boys in Esquimalt. They were also Crips. There was the Crips Mafia cartel. There was one called Natives with Attitude that came out of Esquimalt, and it was First Nations boys. There was the Metro Crew, there was Turbo Crew, there were the Jacks, and then there was a group out of Blanchard Courts as well.
While talk about gangs dominated the news, there was also an outpouring of remembrance and support for Rena and her family.
Next to a playground for children and the path that people stroll for reflection by the waterway in which Rena lost her life, 300 gathered in threatening rain to express shock, horror, and a commitment that this would be the last.
As we say goodbye to Rena, the door closes, but a new window opens, a window of hope and compassion. These when we're not together as a community, not working for a better place, that sad things happen.
We are asking you, everyone, to commit to nonviolence, to tolerate, respect, value, and appreciate each other.
The extensive media coverage about the case often portrayed Rena Virk as a troubled misfit who fell in with the wrong crowd. But her family said she was so much more than that. And they wanted people to remember her as a smart kid who won prizes in math. She loved to draw and worked on the school yearbook. She dreamed of becoming a writer. But most of all, she just wanted friends. Graham says for him, one of the saddest parts about what happened is that Rena didn't get to see how many people actually cared about her.
More people, as we are adults and as we move forward in life and we have children and we become parents and leaders, we sympathize with the person who's been picked on. And not only that, we have great empathy towards them and we want to help them because we've all felt that. But she didn't, she never got to know that night. That there were millions of people out there who did care and did relate to her story of being outed or being othered or being made to feel different than others.
The first of many trials in this case began in February 1998, less than 3 months after Rena's murder. 16 girls involved in the initial attack were charged with aggravated assault. But before the trial started, their charges were lowered to the lesser offense of assault causing bodily harm. Then, in a surprise move, three of the accused pleaded guilty on the first day of the trial.
Rena Virk's grandfather says he's come to court for his granddaughter. He's pleased three young women entered guilty pleas today.
No, we know what happened to those three girls, and they accepted what they were charged for. That's all we can do. And I'm pleased the way court is handling it.
Missy Plyke and Nicole Cook, the two teens who lured Rena to the shoreline field with the intent of beating her up, were among the three who pleaded guilty. Court heard they not only accused Rena of taking Nicole's phone book and spreading rumors about her, but they also believed that Rena was trying to steal Missy's boyfriend. It was revealed that both girls came from troubled backgrounds and were in the care of the province at the time of the attack. A short trial was held for the other three girls. They appeared in court dressed casually and seemed bored during legal arguments, alternately gazing around the room, chewing their fingernails, or simply staring straight ahead. Multiple teen witnesses were called to the stand and testified how Rena was chased and swarmed by the accused girls. But the defense maintained that they didn't take part in the attack. They only watched it. In the end, the judge hearing the case disagreed and found all three guilty. In their first sign of emotion, the girls held hands and cried as the verdict was read out loud. Like the three that had already pleaded guilty, they also had troubled backgrounds. In fact, two of the teens had lost their fathers to murder. Rena's mom said she had empathy for their sad backgrounds, but said it didn't excuse what they did to Rena that night. Even still, at the end of the trial, Suman Virk hugged some of the guilty girls' parents, telling them how sorry she was that they had to go through such a horrible ordeal. The teens known as the Shoreline Six were handed sentences ranging from 60 days conditional custody to 1 year in jail for their parts in the first attack on Rena. In April 1999, nearly a year and a half after Rena's death, Warren Glowatsky's second-degree murder trial began at Victoria's BC Supreme Court. The 17-year-old had battled to have his case heard in youth court, but lost, and now was being tried as an adult. The short, slightly built teen, who looked younger than his age, glanced around nervously as he entered the courtroom in handcuffs. In a barely audible voice, he pleaded not guilty to the murder of Rena Virk. Rena's parents sat solemnly in court as disturbing details were revealed throughout the trial, including testimony from the pathologist who performed the autopsy. Dr. Laurel Gray told the court the 14-year-old was alive but likely unconscious when she ended up in the gorge waterway. Graham Duffy says that even though Rena's official cause of death was listed as drowning, Dr. Gray said the teen suffered head injuries that were severe enough to kill her.
The pathologist described the extent of her injuries, which included severe bruising all over her entire skull, her forehead, ears, and cheeks. Her brain was swollen, and there was an imprint of a running shoe on her head and brain. Now, this was consistent with being stomped or kicked. The pathologist also found severe bruising on Rena's pelvis, her stomach, her liver, and her pancreas. Like, this list of injuries is horrific.
Another Crown witness called to the stand was Glowatsky's former girlfriend. She had been at the Shoreline Field the night in question, but went home early before Rena was swarmed under the bridge because she wasn't feeling well. Sarita Hartley had previously told police that Glowatsky had confessed to her about what happened. But when she got on the stand, Caitlin says it was like pulling teeth as the Crown struggled to get answers.
Sarita was a torn, 14-year-old girl who was in love. Her first love was Warren Glowatsky, so she felt kind of loyal to him, and she was also afraid of being labeled a rat, and I think all of that weighed heavily on her. And once she was actually on the stand and sitting across from her first boyfriend, Warren, all of that prep went out the window. And Sarita, who was forthcoming in those interviews with police, claimed to not remember things or to be mixing up facts and rumor, unsure of which was which. And the Crown was actually forced to read her statements that she had given to police back to her. And she kind of claimed like not to remember what she had said. And her most common answer on the stand was, "I don't know."
When Glowatsky took the stand, he was dressed in a Tommy Hilfiger shirt. He was teary-eyed and trembling as he admitted being present for the second attack on Rena. But the teen said he did not hit Rena. He testified that Kelly Ellard was the one who beat and killed her while he pleaded with her to stop. Glowatsky told the court he left before the attack ended and didn't know she was dead until 5 days later. When the judge delivered his verdict in June 1999, Sarita Hartley and several other teen girls from Shoreline sat in court listening as the judge read out his decision. The judge said, on the whole, Glowatsky's evidence was incomplete and improbable. He said, quote, "I did not believe him. I find Warren Glowatsky guilty of second-degree murder as charged." As the verdict was read out, Glowatsky turned his head to face the public for the last time. In the packed courtroom, he couldn't see that his father was sitting in the back row by himself. He had flown in from California, where he had moved in the months before Rena's murder. After his dad moved, Glowatsky was essentially homeless. His mom, who struggled with addiction issues, was living in another province, so the 16-year-old was forced to couch surf. Neither of his parents were in court when Glowatsky was sentenced 2 weeks later. The 18-year-old was handed a sentence of life in prison with no chance of parole for 7 years to be served at an adult medium security facility. The judge described Glowatsky as a troubled, immature young man who had difficulty dealing with the effects of the breakdown of his family. Within minutes of sentencing, Glowatsky's lawyers filed an appeal, which was later rejected by the court. All that remained in the case was the prosecution of Kelly Ellard. But no one could have predicted the lengthy and complicated legal battle that would take more than a decade and test the justice system and the fortitude of the Virk family. That's next time on History of the 90s in part 2 of the murder of Rena Virk. Thanks for listening to part 1, and special thanks to Caitlin and Graham of True North True Crime, my partners on this episode. You can find their podcast wherever you're listening to this one right now. If you have a topic you want covered by History of the 90s, send me a message on Instagram at That90sPodcast, or you can reach me by email. The address is 90s@curiouscast.ca. This episode was written by me, Kathy Canzora, along with Caitlin and Graham Duffy. Our producer is Dila Velasquez, and technical production is by Rob Johnston. See you next time for more History of the 90s. Dinner with the Parents is a remake of the award-winning British comedy about two brothers in their 20s who go to their parents' house every Friday night and somehow get through it without physically dying of embarrassment. Starring Michaela Watkins, Dan Bacadal, Carol Kane, Henry Hall, Daniel Thrasher, and John Glazer. The closely knit Langer family prove that it takes those we love best to bring out our worst. All new Thursdays at 9, only on Showcase. Stream on Stack TV.